Hello and welcome to the Maine Reader on Maine Airs, a service of the Iris Network. My name is Randy Labar. I am reading Suburban Safari, A Year on the Lawn by Hannah Holmes. Copyright 2005 by Hannah Holmes, published by Bloomsbury Publishing, New York, New York. In the last episode, the author was beginning her backyard observation. It was the spring and the hummingbirds were just arriving. We resume with episode 2 of Suburban Safari on page 13. Hummers are ragged edge birds. Like weightlifters, they're all muscle, and muscle burns food like crazy. They're bad at making fat, so they can't store much energy. Worse still, they lack the layer of downy feathers that keep other birds warm at night. But no animal can survive long on the ragged edge, so hummers have evolved their own way of saving calories. They hibernate for one night at a time. They routinely chill their bodies by 4 to 8 degrees overnight, and if need be, they can turn the thermostat down 16 degrees. Like tiny bears, they slow their breathing and depress their heart rate from 1,000 beats per minute to just 150. On a cold spring morning like this, my hummers may need 15 minutes to power up to flying temperature. Right now, they're awake, a little too awake. Two males and a female are mining the quince, and they're not sharing peaceably. They point their spears at each other and make blurry charges. For a small animal, a hummer can produce an intimidating series of twitters. Neighbor Hugh, walking by on the sidewalk, raises a hand to his face when he sees the birds sparring. "Whoa," he says, "watch your eyes." I fill a feeder and hang it near the back deck. The hummers find it within seconds. One male declares it his private property. Between drinking binges, he stares at it from the depths of a forsythia bush. When I walk between him and his sugar water, he cusses. He buzzes hummers who approach his feeder, boys and girls alike. He seems to convert sugar water directly to belligerence. His aggression will probably win him a girl, whom he'll impregnate and abandon, leaving her to raise the children. Every morning now, a new bird chimes in with the chorus. About 80% of the birds that breed in North America, including the orioles, goldfinches, and warblers that are brightening my muddy yard, have to find their way from points south to points north every spring. Some return to the same corner of the same yard where they nested the previous year. How do they do it? Reading up on bird navigation, I stumble on this peculiar fact. A robin can find his way around with his left eye taped shut, but not with his right eye taped shut. The marvelous explanation offered by researchers is that the Earth's magnetic field sparks a chemical reaction inside the bird's right eyeball, transferring directional data to the brain. The magnetic information amounts to a map. Because magnetic fields shift and distort the map, birds can also see a plane of polarized light that follows the sun across the sky. They use the sun to correct the magnetic map. Songbirds, who migrate at night, use the stars to correct their map. Eye taping is the tip of the iceberg in terms of migration experiments. Scientists also put birds in planetariums and spin the stars at abnormal speeds to see if the birds reorient themselves accordingly. They do. They put impressionable young birds in planetariums with fake starscapes to see whether the star map is innate or learned. It's learned. They generate phony magnetic fields around birds to see if their sense of direction warps accordingly. It does. The birds winging into my yard this spring are the winners in the orienteering challenge. Untold numbers of losers exhausted themselves flying around lighted towers, got lost, blew off course, ran out of fuel over the ocean, or crossed the ocean to discover that a drought has killed their food. Which brings me back to sustenance. I hung a hummingbird feeder because I thought these travelers needed extra calories. But, of course, hummingbirds did just fine before Artline made feeders, and they evidently do just fine if you don't change the sugar water in the feeder. I didn't know that fungal spores can get in through the yellow flowers and sponsor dynasties in the syrup. After a couple of weeks, I don't see any more hummers. I figure they've migrated onward, but then I spy them jousting over the flower beds. When I wash the feeder and refill it, they return in a matter of hours. But they've obviously survived without me. That hummers find a feeder so quickly hints at their smarts. Experiments show that they're not born with an urge to find red blooms. They learn this preference. When my hummer child eventually emerges from his half-walnut of a nest this summer, he'll display a frightful ignorance of botany. He'll hover hungrily in front of brown lilac seeds, tapping them with his needle. He'll investigate twigs. He'll probe leaves. But over time, his sugar-sensitive brain will identify a pattern. Many of the flowers with the highest sugar content are, by chance, red. Thus, hummers learn to love red. They learn it so well that they'll sip sugar water from a red flower painted around a belly button, or allegedly from lipsticked and puckered lips. Another sugar junkie is stoking his mojo as he passes through the neighborhood. A Baltimore Oriole, feathered in glowing orange, black, and white, perches on the post that holds the hummingbird feeder. I make a special trip to the supermarket for an orange and lay oriole-colored slices on the deck railing. But this guy has other plans. I can't fathom the goal at the end of his plans, but this is how he carries them out. He hops around in one of my old apple trees, peeking into the clusters of emerging leaves. He spends hours doing this. Another male arrives and does the same. Separately, over 3 days, they examine every inch of each old apple tree in the neighborhood. They ignore the two pear trees. A week or so later, when the trees blossom, the oriole plan gets a little clearer. Each apple tree unfolds only about a half dozen flowers. The orioles ate all the buds. My botanical aunt tells me that this is completely normal for an oriole, but I fail to find printed proof in an academic journal. The oriole expert I locate tells me the birds simply wouldn't eat the buds because they can't digest cellulose. But a friend checks her birder's handbook for me. Lo and behold, according to Paul Ehrlich and friends, orioles do indeed eat apple blossoms. Now I'm intrigued. If the buds are made of indigestible cellulose, what makes them worth eating? After some poking around, I conclude it's their pink pigments. Through much of the bird world, it's the gentlemen, not the ladies, who dress in showy plumage. Ladies, according to the dominant theory, prefer the gent who wears the brightest colors. Birds can produce blue and green pigments in their own bodies. But birds with red, orange, or yellow plumage have to eat foods with carotenoid pigments in them. Male orioles fall into this category, and apple blossoms contain red pigment. Hence, it is my personal theory that orioles eat blossoms to extract the carotenes. The only fly in my theoretical ointment is that birds can't store pigments and have to eat them during the molt when they're growing new feathers. And the main molt comes in autumn. However, my oriole expert did let slip that some young males molt in the spring, so perhaps that was the ulterior oriole goal. The young men, eager to awe the ladies with their brilliance, strip-mined the apple trees for their colors. Carotene coloring is popular with the birds in my yard. The cardinal and goldfinch fellows both are intensely colored, from the beak to butt. Biologists talk about animal features having costs because the labor required to build and maintain any one feature leaves less energy for other chores. A peacock's tail, for instance, is expensive because it's heavy to carry around, and it probably slows a peacock's escape from predators. The reddest cardinals have to locate a good source of red or yellow fruit and spend energy battling other males who also want it. If that red food isn't very nutritious, then the red feathers are even more expensive. Those pricey feathers must yield a benefit. The reddest cardinal males, I learn, win the thickest, most predator-proof nest sites. That makes redness a true signal, a reliable sign that the guy is fit. Further evidence that color indicates vitality comes from experiments with blackbirds, whose yellow bills fade when they're sick. Not surprisingly, then, the reddest cardinals also attract the fittest females, those who start laying eggs early in the season, enabling them to raise two families by summer's end. The day of winning a mate, however, is still distant for many of the birds in my yard. Most are only resting here before racing onward to stake a claim in their preferred habitat. Watching the traffic at my rest area, I spot birds I've never seen before. A Swainson's thrush, a bewilderment of warblers, a white-crowned sparrow, a cuckoo, large and handsome flickers, Carolina wrens, and something I record in my notes as a cute little leaf kicker. Most of these will raise their families somewhere a little more private than the suburbs. The thrush wants a spruce forest, my bird guide says. The white-crowned sparrow is hoping for boreal scrub. Heaven only knows what the leaf kicker has in mind. And heaven only knows where they'll all find their dream homes. One of the reasons the songbird population is crashing is that North America is being converted from spruce forest and boreal scrub into Walmarts and white-crowned sparrow estates. Another reason is that the winter homes of many of these birds in Mexico, Central America, and the Caribbean are also being converted from bird habitat to habitat for people, cows, and sun-grown coffee trees. Most birds have evolved to eat specific seeds and insects, to use a particular plant for nest making, and to build those nests in a certain density of forest to protect it from egg-stealing predators. When people turn a forest into a lawn, pasture, or parking lot, the resident birds must find another source of food, shelter, and home construction. They're failing with flying colors. It takes a special bird to deny millions of years of tradition and adapt its lifestyle to a new ecosystem. It takes a crow, a goose, or a chickadee. Mating season comes at different times for different birds. Today it's the state bird who's screaming bloody murder. One black-capped chickadee perches in my chokecherry tree, and another sits in the lilac hedge 15 feet away. Once upon a time I would have regarded their noise as singing, but there's no joy in the hearts of these animals. They're hurling death threats across the lawn. Well, it's not quite that bad. Their contest does have serious consequences, though. The winner will keep his girl at home. The loser's girl may wait until his back is turned, then flit to the challenger's branch. After a speedy rendezvous, she'll return to her partner. She'll lay an egg fertilized by the competitor, and her mate will squander his energy protecting and feeding another man's progeny. This all hinges on a fellow's singing. The duel is a daily affair, and the tune is a simple phoebe. The average chickadee might phoebe just to assert his property rights, but an aggressive chickadee will make a vocal assault. He'll adjust his pitch to match his opponent's, then try to drown him out. To the victor goes the girls. In recent years, scientists have concluded that many birds, males and females alike, are terrible cheats, obsessed with securing the best available genetic input for their offspring. But chickadees are particularly status conscious. The wife, of my neighborhood's highest-ranking male is the woman most likely to cheat if she hears her husband shouted down. And if that woman should fall to a cat or a car, the second-ranked wife will dump her own husband to shack up with the bereaved. The state birds may be cute, but they're tireless screamers and ruthless schemers. Chickadees aren't doing all the shouting, of course. Male birds throughout the neighborhood are so awash in springtime testosterone that they can't keep their mouths shut. Cardinal boys holler at each other, "Wheat, wheat, wheat!" Dueling catbirds string together imitations of chickadees, cardinals, and seagulls, plus species I suspect them of inventing. A starling runs through a repertoire of mimicry that includes the terrified shriek of a 2-year-old child. This is so realistic that after I ascertain there is no terrified child involved, I conduct a web search on starling. I find the site of a woman who has taught 2 rescued starlings to talk. I click a button. "Hello, Storm," Stormy says in a high and creepy whisper. "Stormy's a pretty bird." The starling's repertoire, like the chickadee's volume, is a personal ad promoting a man's strength. In my north neighbor's yard, a starling male stands beside the apple tree hole he has procured and sings the longest, most complicated song he can muster. He warbles and clicks, creaks and tweedles. He screams like a toddler. Among nearby female starlings, the song is cause for speculation regarding the singer's health and intelligence. Near the end of his song, the soloist hunches over and twitches his wings as though he's being electrocuted. The girls melt. They flutter near to inspect the hole. The lucky birdie who moves in will find that her starling darling brings home flowers, even after they have a nestful of children. Well, not flowers exactly, more like herbs, wild carrot, yarrow, goldenrod, and fleabane, all of which are highly aromatic, and some of which have proven to impede the hatching of parasites that lurk in nests, menacing babies. A girl could do worse than to land a starling. As the ground softens in the sun, a summer community takes shape. Behind the unfurling leaves of the oak and lilac, chokecherry and honeysuckle, and in the depths of the south neighbor's bamboo wilderness, birds couple up. The slate-colored catbirds claim a back corner of the yard, and the starlings settle into their apple tree. With eggs accruing in pouches of sticks, weeds, and feathers throughout the neighborhood, the hormonal tide recedes, and the yelling does too. Songs diminish, and calls arise. Instead of Phoebe, chickadee boys and girls alike chickadee, keeping in touch as they hunt insects on the sumac trees or tuck sunflower seeds behind my gutters. The cardinal couple exchange a domestic pip. Mr. Catbird lays off satirizing his neighbors and now swaps mews with his wife. If I wander too near his corner, he hops onto the fence and cries at me, "Mew!" I cry back, and he cocks his head before repeating the accusation. This is a high-stakes time for all the birds. The crows, like everyone else, have heavily invested in the contents of their nests. They burned countless hours and calories collecting sticks and mud and grapevine bark. Pa Crow led the family force to keep the territory free of invaders. Ma Crow channeled calories and nutrients into her eggs. Pa and the kids fed her as she sat for nearly 3 weeks converting worms, roadkill, squirrel, and pizza crusts into heat, which passed through the skin of her featherless brood patch and warmed the eggs. If the nest tumbles in a high wind, or if a raccoon or squirrel gets the eggs, all that effort is wasted. But turnabout is fair play, I suppose. Crows themselves are famous home wreckers. In addition to eating other birds' eggs, they'll kill adult birds. They'll even take on larger mammals. Lawrence Killam, author of The American Crow and the Common Raven, reports watching crows hammer on a sickly wild pig and jab a newborn fawn. The fawn was fine, but my admiration for crows felt the blow. One day at the end of May, I follow a worm-bearing crow to the nest, and, aha, two expensive little heads protrude above the nest rim. An adult is gliding in to feed them. Her feet barely touch the nest. The heads rise as she approaches. Soundlessly, she tucks food into the open mouths. Then she's away from the tree, and the heads withdraw into the nest. All the adult crows, both the parents and the elder siblings, bring food to the kids. It's unusual behavior, this sibling helpfulness, and apparently it's not all that helpful. Researchers have set up studies where they monitor some breeding couples who have helpers and some with no helpers. There's no glaring difference in nesting success. Unassisted parents lose no more eggs or babies to predators, so the helpers aren't keeping the nest safer. Nor are more babies lost to starvation, so the food that helpers bring isn't crucial. The best guess is that the helpers are helping themselves. When they eventually have children, they'll be seasoned parents. Then again, perhaps after these young helpers get well acquainted with their baby brother, they'll decide against reproducing. I name Yawp in early June, shortly after waking to a symphony of braying crows. I peek outside. The four adults are stationed around a neighbor's house, perched in trees and power lines. They're flinging gusts of complaint toward the neighbor's porch roof. On that roof is a crow, picking bits of gravel off the shingles and toying with maple twirlies. From time to time, this crow looks around, opens his wide beak, and says, "Yawp!" There's a hint of complaint in that expression. In tone, it's akin to a kazoo. When an adult flies overhead, the youngster flutters and gapes. "Yawp!" The adults rain another storm of cawing upon him. Yawp picks up a maple seed and drops it. He has tried flying. He didn't care for it. When I study up on this stage of crow life, I find that youngsters leave the nest a bit prematurely. They typically spend a few days on the ground, or in low trees, figuring out the flying business. The parents feed them and worry loudly as the kids fumble around the neighborhood, dodging cats, dogs, cars, and crow haters. I go out to check on Yawp an hour after his debut, and find him settled into the porch roof gutter. The adults sulk nearby. Later, a neighbor tells me Yawp did finally make a move. He plopped down to the lawn, giving his family fits. In the afternoon, when I don't see him around, I walk to the nest. Both kids are back in it, but just barely. They're hopping from one side of the nest to the other, swapping places. Teetering on the edge, they lift their wings and flap. One crow flap-hops out onto a limb and nibbles an overhead stick. They're busy, busy, busy. The next day, the other kid, the quiet kid, gets her flying lesson. The four adults fly through the neighborhood in a clump. Tagging behind, veering all over the skyway, is a fifth crow. When the grown-ups reach their territorial boundary, they turn left, but their protégé does not. They race back and herd her to a tall tree with slim vertical branches. The young crow flaps and grips a branch. The branch bends to a right angle. She flaps to stay upright, but the branch can't support her. She flaps free and tries another, over and over. Even when she finds a sturdy branch, the tossing wind keeps her off balance. It's baby season all over. In neighbor Hugh's yard, English sparrow babies are fluttering and begging loudly in the grass. In my yard, they're investigating the litter under the lilac hedge, testing everything in their beaks. Petals are rejected. Twigs are rejected. Leaves are rejected. I don't know what they accept, but they're exploring at full tilt. On my walkway, a youngster I can't identify has discolored an endless source of little protein packets. He waits beside an anthill. The Crow kids are fully mobile within a few days, and they, too, work the yard. Well, the quiet one does. She has a droopy wing, perhaps from crash landing in a tree. Like her elders, she walks quietly through the grass, hunting worms. Droopy, I call her. Droopy is an intelligent crow. Yawp, though, is a nightmare crow. I can hear him from one end of the neighborhood to the other. Yawp! Yawp! He starts at dawn, and he goes until dusk. Today he rushes each family member in turn as they pull up worms. Yawp! He assails his first victim, but that bird turns away and swallows fast. Yawp runs toward his sister when she scores, but she shreds and eats her worm alone. Then a third crow flies into the yard, and when the squalling brat approaches, this crow opens wide. Yawp dives into the black throat to gulp a meal. There follows a gorgeous minute of quiet as he swallows. Then he resumes kazooing. He's a bottomless pit, and he has no intention of filling himself. One insight afforded by Yawp's ever-gaping maw is that young crows have pink mouth linings, in contrast to their parents' black ones. Baby birds can be difficult to distinguish from adults. Some wear a duller suit of feathers than their parents, and many sport a wedgier bill, but these can be subtle distinctions. My crow babies do have brown feathers, as opposed to black, but the brown is so dark I can only distinguish them in the direct sunlight. Even that clue is being diluted as new black feathers emerge. So if Droopy's wing isn't drooping, and Yawp isn't yawping, I have to fall back on clues won through hours of study with the binoculars, such as the pink mouths and the fat beaks. They also lack the pronounced ridge over the eyes that gives the grown-ups their noble expression. In profile, the kids have smaller heads. Their tails come to a square end, while adult tails are rounded. The kids' legs are set closer together, which produces a less swaggering gait. And they're a hair smaller than the adults, but all these traits are so hard to spot that, as with pigeons, I expect most people believe they've never laid eyes on a baby crow. Well, that's all we have time for on this edition of The Maine Reader. We are reading Suburban Safari, A Year on the Lawn by Hannah Holmes. This is The Maine Reader on Maine Airs. My name is Randy LaBarre. Thank you for listening.